Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 37, John Moriarty's Christmas Visions with Amanda Carmody. Our guest, Amanda Carmody, joins us to speak about her uncle and dear friend, John Moriarty. If you're a frequent Knot Work listener, this name, John Moriarty, will be familiar to you. He is the late, great Irish writer and philosopher who really blended mysticism and visions of modernity in such profound and compelling ways. Amanda spent meaningful time with John and later devoted many years to studying his wisdom teachings. Over the past 6 years, she has shared that work widely through institutes, festivals, reading groups, workshops, blogs, and online classes. The John Moriarty community that she fosters over on Facebook is one of the reasons to stay on that particular platform. Amanda has a background in visual display and design and is also an author and illustrator, as well as the co-editor of John Moriarty, Grounded in Story. And most importantly, Amanda is the mother of three remarkable children, Damien, Sarah, and Anna. Amanda knows firsthand how John Moriarty's work can be a shelter, a companion, and a deep reservoir of meaning through the dark night of the soul. And now, as we enter into this darkest time of the year, I'm so grateful to bring her voice and John Moriarty's voice here to the podcast. Before we immerse ourselves in today's episode, I wanted to let you know that the doors are now open for the 2026 edition of The Author's Knot. This is our intimate 10-month online writing program for thought leaders, memoirists, novelists, and heart-led visionaries working on a book or another big project in the new year. The Author's Knot will help you strengthen your voice, clarify your message, deepen your craft, and truly commit to your creative work so that you can bring the fullness of your vision to life and to the page. This will be the second year that I'm offering this program, and I'm grateful to say that 2025's program was a deep and nourishing success. Here's what one member, Ashley, says about her experience. Magic happens when we gather, even more so when you're in the presence and care of Marisa Gowdy. I've had the privilege and honor to work with Marisa one-on-one. She's a skilled writing coach and wordsmith, but what she forges in the Author's Knot is something to behold. An intimate container that not only helps the heart shape the story it wants to tell, but also shapes the heart of the writer. Ashley goes on, I now know I'm a novelist, and not just because I have the pages to prove it. The added bonus is the like-minded soul friends you'll meet who are just as wonderful as the woman who's tending the sacred flame of this group. I am beyond touched to be able to share words like these, and I would be honored to hold space for your words in the year to come. Visit my website, marisagowdy.com, and look for the Author's Knot. I'm now taking applications for the program that begins at the end of January 2026. Well, I am so excited to welcome Amanda to the podcast today. And as is our way at Knot Work Myth and Storytelling, we first ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways that it matters and resonates today. So Amanda, welcome. I'm so excited to hear this story from John Moriarty, your uncle, and to dive deeper into so many of his other stories that you've told across a lifetime. Welcome. Fáilte.
Thank you very much, Marisa. I'll start with the very first story John tells in his autobiography, Nostos. So John is 5 years old and he's remembering. And this is a kind of a foundational story in John's work because it dictates so much for the rest of his writing and his stories. Lapwings, I remember. My mother lighting the lamp, and in the field in front of the house, lapwings calling. Every call a complaint. Or so it seemed to me. And the wonder was that even when they were being battered by hailstones, they didn't alter their complaints. They neither lengthened nor deepened them. In all weathers and at all hours of the night, their complaints were as elegant as their crests. What saddened me is that they were so frightened of me. I only had to walk into the field and instantly they would become a flock of shimmering, swiftly swerving as they flew, and then, as though quenching themselves, they would land further off among the rushes, maybe where I'd no longer be able to see them. That's what had happened this evening. But now again at nightfall, they had come back to the richer feeding grounds beside the house. And that I was glad of, because ours was a house that lapwings could come close to. Then surely also it was a house that angels could come close to. Surely tonight they would come close, because since darkness had begun to fall, it was Christmas Eve, and Madeline, my oldest sister, was singing Silent Night, Holy Night, and Chris had brought 2 bags of turf from the shed, and Babs had brought 2 buckets of water from the well, and already its flame perfectly calm, the lamp was giving more light than the fire, with its raptures big and small. Lamplight and firelight, that was every night. Tonight was different. Looking at the crib in the deep sill of our front window, I could see that the light of the highest heaven was in our house. It was a night of wonders. Tonight, all night, the gates of heaven would be open above us, riding animals higher than our house and wearing glittering vestments, not clothes. The 3 wise men might pass through our yard tonight. And if they did, our father would show us the tracks in the morning. Plain as could be, he saw them last Christmas morning. And Santa Claus would come, and he would bring us what we asked for. There was no denying it. It was wonderful. And in the glow of fellow feeling with all our animals, I went out and crossed the yard to the cow stall. Pushing open the door, I looked in, and at first, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. No candles lighting in the windows. No holly, no crib. No expectations of kings or angels, no sense of miracles. What I saw was what I saw on any other night. 11 short horn cows, some of them standing, some of them lying down, some of them eating hay, and some of them chewing the cud, and 2 of them turning to look at me. Devastated, I had to admit it was an ordinary night in the cow stall. Coming back across the yard, I looked at the fowl house and the piggery, and the darkness and the silence that had settled on them couldn't say it any more clearly. Christmas hadn't happened in the outhouses. Christmas hadn't happened to the animals. The animals were left out, and since the animals were left out, so inside me, somewhere, was I. In our house, everything turned out as we had expected it would. We had cornbread for supper. Madeline leading the way, we sang the few bits of Silent Night that we knew. Around 9 o'clock, we went up to my mother's and father's room and found that Santa had come. We played snakes and ladders till we were dead tired. I was 5 years old and I was having a bad Christmas. And it wasn't because in the last 3 games I had landed more often on the mouth of a snake than on the foot of a ladder. I couldn't forget the dark stall.
Oh, Amanda, thank you. I think I was both laughing and tearing up and everything all the way through. Thank you for bringing us a story that would have been what, maybe Christmas 1943 or so?
Yes, if he was 5 years old, he was born in 1938. And I think it's just very beautiful because we all have that wonder child sense somewhere inside us, mm-hmm. where we want to be one with, we want the animals, we want our dogs, our cats, our cows to have Christmas as well. Yes. And we grow out of that, or we become conditioned out of that. So he's bringing us back to that sense of oneness between the child and the animal, I think.
I love just at the early passages of that story, the pride of having a house that Lapwings could come close to. And I feel like every time I read his work, I find new goals in my heart I didn't know I had. Like, oh, I want a home that lets the birds sit close and come in and feel that momentary elusive safety. It just opens me every time. So again, thank you and welcome.
I think it's amazing that the very first line of John's autobiography is Lapwings, I remember. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think like he puts it right there deliberately. The lapwings are first and foremost these little birds. So as random as his writing sometimes seems, it's actually very, very deliberate that John would do that, I believe anyway, yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, I just love even just the such the deeply human and the childhood imagery of playing snakes and ladders and that sense of, and I was just listening to, he did that, Monkon Magon did a gorgeous podcast series called The Bog Shaman, and he was talking about a recording that John did around Take It the Crooked Pathways. And it just reminded me so much of that and those comparisons of, you know, the straight lines of the world and how it's supposed to be these straight canals as we're given in these certain ways. But John was celebrating the curves of the river. And it just seems to echo so much in terms of taking that, the crooked way of the serpent's path seems to echo in here compared to those ladders that you go straight up.
That's very interesting because that's the story John tells in Connemara about cutting the lino to fit the old castle walls. And John leans over the counter to say that, look, to the workman, I think you're cutting it crooked. But the workman then says that in an old castle like this, in a lovely old castle, to cut it crooked is that it'll fit straight. So, yeah, he goes on to talk about the Ormond River and the mountains and the crookedness in nature. I relate back to my own experience. I did a bit of art in school, and one of the first lessons the art teacher said is there is no straight lines in nature. And I think that's probably true. And John proceeds then to tell another beautiful Christmas story in that same, I think it's the third story. He tells about a local man in the parish. He went drinking on Christmas Eve, and I can read you that scene as it has come up kind of organically at this stage.
Beautiful, yeah.
So it is about a man called John Welch, and he lived locally. It's about all that we are is holy and sacred, that nothing is excluded or should be excluded from the holiness. So we've already done about animals, but this is a man. A local man. John Welch lived in a world of high horizons. His house was high on the side of a hill, and from the fields he farmed, he looked down, looking southwest on the Shannon, losing its identity in the ocean. His was a world of wide questions that required wide answers. Questions and answers that made sense on the shores of Galilee didn't always make same sense, kind of sense, on the shores of the ocean. Like a boat, John's religion had opened at the seams. It was drawing unchristian water. It was drawing water that wasn't, all of it, baptized in the traditional Christian story. John was lonely, but not because there were no people in his life. He was lonely because of his uncommon intuitions about things. Sometimes, having milked them, John would drive out his cows and go down to the village and drink for the day. And so it was one Christmas Eve, John was more alone than ever when coming up to 11 o'clock, Eileen, the barwoman, called on everyone to finish their drink and go to midnight mass. When the pub was almost empty, John went to Eileen and asked her for a few bottles of Guinness to take away. He dropped them down into the pockets of his great crumbly overcoat and walked out, following the others. As usual, John didn't go into the great blaze of the church. John felt uncomfortable in places from which the dark was totally excluded. The porch with its shadows was more hospitable to him, and that's where he stayed. Everything was proceeding that night as everyone expected it would. Angels sweetly singing had been heard on high. Orient kings, who were also wise men, had mounted their camels and set out. following a star, shepherds above them, whom the heavens had suddenly opened, were already in reverence, extinguishing their lanterns at the stable door. Then the choir in the gallery above the porch was silent. And except for an odd cough echoing in the vaults, the people also were silent. It was now the offertory of the Mass, and John Welch, in his Wellington boots and his Crombie overcoat, he staggering up the aisle, in row after row, as he wove his way, people lifted their heads up out of their introverted holy hush and looked in alarm at John. Where in Christ's name is he going? What in Christ's name is he up to now, they wondered, in some cases audibly. But however unsurely, John kept walking. Reaching the altar rails, he called to the priest. Knowing there was no harm at all in John, the priest was not alarmed. Composing himself, John rested the bottle of Guinness on the marble rails and said, I've come up, Father, because I wanted to stand a drink to Jesus for Christmas. Having done what he had wanted to do, John turned and, looking neither right nor left, he wove his way down the aisle, out into the shadows of the porch, where in his own very poor estimation of himself, he naturally belonged, or so he thought. Sitting as I was on a rock on top of Dorada Hill, I allowed the story to console me. In church and in school, I heard a voice crying out, make straight the way of the Lord. A voice crying out in a near eastern desert and near to home on a heath. A voice crying out, but to the girdle do the gods inherit. But here he is, John Welch, staggering up the immodestly straight aisle, staggering not only because he had been drinking, staggering also under the burden of his alarming humanity. And the glow of fellow feeling quenched. That's the story of John Welch. So I really like it, because what John is saying there, it isn't just our straightness, it isn't just our virtues that we honour Christmas with, or these are not just the gifts we bring. So I suppose, again, he's continuing the idea that there should be no separation between the sacred and the natural, between the light and the shadows, really. So I think that's fascinating.
Oh, completely. That line, his alarming humanity, right? It was just such an invitation to allow, I guess, all of ourselves in our alarming humanity. And then was it a line that John Welch was uncomfortable in a place where the dark was totally excluded?
Yeah, and that echoes another idea that John presents in Nostos. He says he was thankful he was reared in a house that had, before electricity, before running water. So their house was lit by a paraffin lamp and the firelight, of course. And he writes that he was glad that all darkness was not excluded from the world, because the light casts shadows, you know, and it wasn't a glaring light. So John says he's very thankful that the light and the shadow, and he describes it as like a gypsy dance that went on between them, you know, with light and darkness. So I think that's a theme in John's work about not excluding the bits of us that may not be shining brightly always. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it was in reading John's work that I came into a relationship with a word that I had sort of forgotten or maybe never fully understood, and that was ecumenicism. And I feel like that feels that that's really deeply related to what we're saying, though, as he looked across so many different traditions, but also the traditions that are inside of all of us.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I think that this is John's most important message. Like, he talks about things that he brought back from his travels in Canada and his contact with the indigenous peoples of North America. And one word he has it actually on his headstone is Mitikuya Ayosan, and it means we are all related or we are all kin. And I think that if I was to sum up John's entire philosophy in two words, it would be that phrase, because he is bringing us back to, he's trying to heal the divide. where we are hierarchically higher or further on the ladder than other species, than other people. You know, this divide that happens between religions and between peoples of different ethnic backgrounds, he takes it deeper than that. He takes it to the level of, we're not a hierarchy, we're part of a great web of growing and great web of evolution that includes everything. Mm-hmm. And I suppose we're learning more about that now. Like, say 20 years ago in Ireland anyway, you know, we were spraying weeds and we were getting rid of insects and we were, you know, using chemicals to do all this. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we now focus more on, having lost things like bees and insects and earthworms, we're realizing the value they were to our ecosystem and to our environment. So, you know, we're realizing the importance of not excluding anything and finding a place for everything, and everything has its place in the great web of life. So I think when John says ecumenical, he's included, it's not just religious. It's important to say it's the whole of nature, it's the whole of being. In the Irish tradition, he writes a lovely passage in Dreamtime called, and it's quite shamanic, it's called Éanfla, the bird rain. And the bird rain refers to a rain in our Irish mythological system where Conor Amur had a rain, or he was the High King of Ireland, but his rain was ecumenical, mm-hmm. that it was inclusive and it was harmonious. And he says, I mean, he writes at one stage that he had a vision for a return to a kind of an ecumenical way of being. And he hoped that that could happen again in Ireland, because he says his hope was that Ireland hadn't lost all those dragon energies, all those earth energies that could allow that to be possible, that we haven't completely forgotten our roots. So he was very hopeful. I mean, he's pointing out the wounds, but he is very hopeful. And why John told stories is, I see it like this now, that his stories are like a medicine bundle.
Mm. Yeah.
Like a medicine bundle. And you can dip in and you can take out a story today and it may offer you something, mm-hmm. or it may come from somewhere else. But mm-hmm. in that way, they're kind of a healing bundle. But his hope was certainly for, you know, to take away that wound, that original wound that has existed for a very, very long time, he would say.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Amanda, there's so much there. And I feel as you speak, I just keep feeling like tears rising in me. It makes it hard to talk. It's the sense of a sacred overwhelm in so many ways. And I think that's something that I experience when I read his work, and I realize I could come back and just open up page 192 of any book in any day and know that I could trust that that would be a story perhaps that I would need. Because I know something you and I were speaking before we started recording a bit about, you know, both the magic of our digital realms and the overwhelm that comes with it. And I know for me, it's often that sense of the endless push on to the new and the novel and the needing to take on, you know, the next episode, the next story, the next this, the next that. But something that I feel like I've learned from reading his work over the last few years is just every one of these stories wants me to come back and dwell with them on it. You know, when the sun is coming from a different angle on a different day, and just allow myself to keep receiving. Because, you know, I was raised a Catholic kid, been moved away from that, so, you know, a long time ago. So I've moved away from that repetition of going and recognizing there's like a liturgical calendar and that these stories would come back round and around again, and we're supposed to hear them. And I realize I hadn't made these connections till this moment of talking with you of, oh, that's an experience that I have encoded deep within myself. And we replicate it as we do in our own adult ways and serpentine ways of finding our own spirit way through the world.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we've been talking about crookedness and crooked roads. He talks about the Trans-Canada Highway. It takes you from A to B with no stops, no scenery, you know, just go and you get to your destination. And he compares that with, you know, the old tracks and trails maybe of ancient Ireland, where you stopped at every gate and you had a chat or you had a smoke or you sat down under an oak tree. Mm-hmm. So I think it's far more about the journey and the story at the end of the day, because I think we were speaking just before we came on in the same vein that, like, John's work is like a tapestry.
Yeah.
So it's like interwoven threads. So I think there is the world story. There is his stories and his collection of stories. But then there is your story, mm-hmm. and how your story interweaves or braids together with that is where it matters. I mean, these stories don't matter as a theory. They don't mm-hmm. matter as a kind of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Where they matter is in how they resonate with the reader or with the listener. And that's what John is doing. Very interesting. At the start of, he has an audio collection, One Evening in Eden, and it's six stories are on that. Mm-hmm. And he introduces six stories with, like, John goes on forever, but with two shorter stories. And he describes what he's telling as parables out of his own Galilee. Parables, he says, parables of the kingdom are constantly enacting themselves in our ordinary everyday lives, mm-hmm. if we have the eyes to see them. So that's what I love about John. So an ordinary person, someone like Martin or someone like Jamie Cassan, you know, that he refers to, these are ordinary people, but he sees them as great wisdom teachers. Somebody like his father, who was an Irish speaker who couldn't read or write, he saw him as a great philosopher and one of his great teachers. Mm-hmm. So I actually love that about John, that he interweaves, you know, he interweaves everything so beautifully. And you can listen to a story when you're 20 that John tells, and you will see something interesting in it. Yeah. But listen to the same story a few years later, and you will find, have I listened to this before? It's telling me something completely different now.
Yeah.
So he meets the reader at their own level. And I think that's part of the genius of the work. Yeah. You know, that's what I find amazing anyway. I find it fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. And just as you were naming a few minutes before, that sense of, you know, the discovery in Ireland and that a recognition of needing to keep the honeybees and the earthworms alive. And just that, so for those who are listening who don't know, like, John spent many years of his life as a gardener. Like, he moved from his academic world into working with the soil, right? And really being so completely in both worlds. And I think that's what offers, I mean, there's obviously such a rooted magic to everything he gives us that's has that sense of knowing the lapwings and knowing those 11 cows in the barn. You know, like, I'm a writing coach, so I talk with people a lot about how the universal is found in the specific. And then that's one of those things that we can think about in a way of, like, your individual story matters. It does. And then there's that masterful way of saying, oh, and I see it and I understand it because I was in that barn with a five-year-old boy looking at 11 short-horned cows. And those are the universal cows in so many ways. They're every cow that ever was. And they are those specific 11 beasts, beings, holding that sacred space on a Christmas night.
I don't know if you're familiar with Robin Wall Kammerer. She's, an indigenous wisdom teacher and a botanist, but she's written Braiding Sweet Grass. One of the things that I was very interested in, and I thought it resonated so perfectly with John, was she said about naming things, about giving the animals names and giving the fields names and the places names and people's names. And she says, we've forgotten that. Mm-hmm. And once you name something, you are treating it with respect. You know, it's no longer an it. It becomes a being. It becomes an identity, and you will relate different to it then once it has a name. And in John's work, he goes so far as to name the earth as Budgaya, which it seems like a very strange thing to do initially. But when I read Robin Wall Kammerer, and I thought, yeah, like, to treat the earth as a living, breathing being and to give it, to name it as such, I mean, that changes how you view it, that changes how you relate. And that's the important thing. That's the big part of the message.
Yes. And, you know, so of course, for me, listening to her, to Robin Wall Kimmerer's work here in North America on Turtle Island, and a place where, you know, I'm in New York State. So it was the lands of the Lenape people. And I'm in a specific town called Esopus. And that was a specific branch of the tribe, but where those people were driven off this land so long ago. And so we have town names and we have a couple of, you know, the rivers they're named. I've taken that and it feels both like a really holy act and perhaps something that I'm like, gosh, the temerity of me, the boldness. But, you know, I walk my dog New. We're going to have so many animals in this conversation today. We started talking about our dogs, but I'm going to bring Nuala, my dog, in with me here. I walk her every morning, and knowing that there are the places where there's the owl grove, or one day I saw a great, I'm not even sure what kind of owl, was the biggest bird I've ever seen, fly through. And then there's the place that's, oh, you know, that's Bear Leap, because that's the place where I had a black bear walk right in front of us. And that, especially here in a place in North America where we don't have the tradition is so broken. We don't have that sense of family land, and that it's become a really powerful process for me, in a way, actually inspired by both of these writers, to say, what if I could just at least name this space for myself too, even if I keep it just private within, it's a way of an act of honoring that doesn't erase what was here before, but maybe it helps me touch that which I can never know intellectually, because I'll never be able to meet a person from 400 years ago who could tell me this hill is that, because when you stand on this hill, you can see the ridge behind us, sort of, yeah, just that missing transmission and how we can fill it in with our own experience, perhaps.
And I think particularly in the Irish language, you know, the names, they reveal so much about the place. You know, they tell you something. They're not just a name imposed from outside. It's like they emerge from the land itself and they mm-hmm. reveal something of the place. So that's a very beautiful thing that we're really taking an interest in. Moncon, of course, being the person who really created a kind of a passion for that in Ireland, which is fantastic.
Yes.
The other thing I was thinking as you were speaking there is John was so influenced by his association and his time spent in Canada and his collecting of the wisdom stories. And he talks about this ancient indigenous way of being and knowing, and that kind of wisdom that we have discarded in the interest of progress, but which we now need, probably, you know, there is a return. I was on a course one night and I can't remember who the speaker was, but he was saying that the demise of our indigenous cultures and the indigenous people, it coincides with the demise of our care of the earth. There's a direct correlation, and that's really no surprise. John talks about the prayer of old man. I have it there somewhere. I might be able to remember it. That, you know, if you're in trouble and if you want to seek guidance and if you want wisdom, that when you sleep and you dream, whatever animal you dream of, that should be your guide, and learn what you can from the animal in that dream and go with that. So it's that kind of interconnection, even in the dreaming, it goes deeper than, you know, surface level, it goes deeper. And the idea that the animals are with us, that nature is on our side rather than going against nature. John tells beautiful story about dolphins, and you know, he says dolphins have been around since the dawn of time and they have evolved for millennia because they have chosen to go with nature, to allow nature to shape their way of being in the world. Mm. Whereas we have tended in the last few centuries at least to try and hammer nature into our needs and into our, you know, for our use and benefit, John would say, you know, for purposes like that. So mm-hmm. there is another way, is what we're being told. And the indigenous people, they kind of natively and intuitively knew that. Mm-hmm. And I often think that in Ireland, you know, we talk about learning new ways of being ecologically friendly, learning new ways of being in community. But not that long ago, you know, when John was young, and before that, that was natural. That what didn't have to be learned. It was just the way things were. And we've forgotten that. And now we have new generations who have technology and who have different ways of being and ways of making progress and learning. But they now have to learn these things that were just automatic. And it's important that, you know, there are carriers of that wisdom. And the great thing about young people is that they are so enthusiastic and full of finding new ways. They are interested in this. It's not like they don't, they do want it, you know, they want this as well. There's a great, especially in Ireland, I think there's a lot of people who are very young and ecologically aware, you know, that things must change.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like it's that unexpected gift that comes with having to make conscious that which was once upon a time either unconscious or instinctual, right? And so in that sense of having to choose to engage with story, and perhaps in engaging even with Christmas stories, because so many of us at this point have a different relationship with religion than we would have, you know, 80 years ago. And that sense of engaging with the land when, you know, food comes off on bits of styrofoam wrapped in plastic from the grocery store, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that disconnection from the source, you know, the source of our food and the source of our wisdom, the source of our language, you know, is to reconnect with the source of things. John had a terrible experience when he was young, witnessing pig being killed or the chicken being killed in a particular part in his of the yard at home. That also happened. So that was also part of that wounding.
Right.
But in a sense, I feel that he could make informed choices because he really did know that this pig that they fed and reared and he had hoped Christmas would be in the piggery, you know, that, you know, this was food for them eventually. So I think that, yeah, like you're saying, the shiny, glossy package with bacon that has no connection to its source is not maybe wise.
Right, right. And yet we can still say, okay, that is how I'm going to eat today. How do I develop relationship with all that is, not in another way, or I guess in just in the way we move through the world? So I know you have another story. Perhaps you want to tell us the Amanda story?
Yeah. So it's the first story John tells. It's the first of the six stories. And I'm 4 years old and John is home from Canada. He was working in Canada and he's home for Christmas to spend it with his parents. Mm. It was Christmas Eve. I was walking down the road to my sister's house. It couldn't have been much after 8 o'clock, but the night was somehow very old. If someone came towards me that night on the road and asked me what time it was, that's what I'd say. It is very old. And it was dark, a dark night, a night when all mirroring was gone from the world. If coming towards me that night on the road, Dan Quinn asked me who I was, I'd have said, I don't know. I only know who I am in a world in which my neighbour mirrors me, in which rivers mirror me, in which mirrors mirror me. But all mirroring is gone from the world tonight. So no, I don't know who I am. Feeling the harshness, the hardness of the road underfoot, in touch only with the hardness, I made my way down to Mikey Fitz's hill. In the hollow below it, I thought of Mag Mahoney's shawl. Mag lived 3 miles away or so at the edge of the bog. In a countryside like this, 3 miles could sometimes make an awful difference. In this case, it amounted to the difference between living in historical time and living in time unperturbed by history. The time Mag lived in couldn't be schismed into epochs and ages, not even by the appearance of a Buddha on earth or a Christ or a Muhammad. Often when I thought about it, I was afraid. How trivial in comparison with the dark seeing, I thought, is the seeing that sees by lamplight, by sunlight, by starlight. Listening, however, to lapwings calling in the bridge field as I walked past it, I soon realized that hearing had, by evocation, given way to an intense visual sensation. Rising, alighting, or in swift swerving flight, the lapwings I saw, not seeing them by sight, were scintillations of the sea. sad scintillations, I thought. They accompanied me all the way to my sister's door, where in a sudden flood of lamplight, they were quenched. So he reaches the door and little Amanda comes out, and they're walking together on the dark road up three hills to Granny's house, where Amanda is to light six candles in Granny's six windows for Christmas. So he continues, "Never was my hand so inclined not to be a fist as when walking together in the dark, Amanda reached so self-consciously for it. No fear tonight that it would regress to foot or fin. In my hand, the child's hand was hope. Hanging from the child's hand in my hand, I hoped was a shepherd's lantern. As I imagine her, not knowing her way, Amanda was a little girl who was beginning to make her way in the big world outside of the protection of her home. Here she was already walking a dark road with a man she hardly knew, aware that I was the protecting one, the guarding one, and what for her was a great adventure, I was more than ever fearful of fault lines in my psyche. Jesus was born in a stable. Throughout my childhood, the bedroom I slept in was so close to a stable that I sometimes smelled horse piss. Little wonder that sometimes I dreamed centaur dreams. The lapwings aren't afraid. Sure they aren't, she said. No, Amanda, no, they're not afraid. And I know why, she said. Why? Because there's lots of them. They have crests, haven't they, and green wings. What's crests, she asked. Little tufts of feathers on their heads. Have you ever seen them up close? No, but I hear them at night. So John goes on here and he tells, they continue on their journey. And as they go, John is thinking as he's going, as always, but he tells a very interesting little Sufi parable in the middle of this. So it's relevant to what we're talking about, because it's about light and searching in brightness. So he tells us the story of a man who is walking home one night, and he goes to search for the key to his house, and he searches in his pocket and he can't find it. And he searches in his other pockets and he can't find it. And the key, he feels, must have fallen down. So he goes, he's under a lamp and he searches for the key, and he's looking around his feet, and he goes down on all fours and he's searching on the ground for the key to his house. And then a police officer comes, and the police officer says, "What are you doing?" And the man says, "I'm searching for the key to my house." And the officer says, "Well, I'll help you. I'll give you a hand." So he gets down on his hands and knees, and he also goes searching for the key under the lamplight. And after a while, they've exhausted every possibility, and they say, "God, it mustn't be here." The policeman says, "Are you sure you lost it here?" And the householder says, "No, I lost it over there in that dark corner." And he says, "Why aren't you searching there?" So the idea of the parable is we're searching maybe with intellectual light and brightness, and we're searching with rational thinking, and maybe the source or the nourishment that perhaps we need is not in that brightness. Like, it's more in the sensory, it's more in the experience, it's more in the indigenous wisdom that we've been talking about so far. So I think that's just a beautiful story. He tells the story of little Amanda is that she started school, and John asks her, he had a punitive experience. School was not a good place for him in his early years. So he asks Amanda, "Do you like school?" And she says, "Yeah, I love it." And he goes on to ask her, "You love it? Well, why do you love it?" And she just says she loves school. And he's fascinated by the idea that the little girl just going out in the world loves school. And he says to her, "And I imagine they all love you." And she answers very lethargically. She says, "Yeah, everyone is stone mad about me." And he makes a big deal about that. Like, it's not the fact that the four-year-old says this to him, it's the lethargy. And that makes him think about, on a night where we're welcoming love and light into the world, and we're going to light candles to do that welcoming, he questions the idea of love in our world. And what he's questioning is the idea of conditional, you know, conditional love. So he goes on to say, he says, mystics who are drawn to the dark not only find this key, I'm going back to the story, they are found by it and they come back marvelously singing and marvelously able for time and eternity. And then, still on the road, with the soles of my feet, I remembered Amanda's answer. Yes, she said wearily, everyone is stone mad about me. Amanda's weariness at being so loved. Why, I wondered, was it that all this love coerced her? Did it suffocate her? Did it deprive her of everything except her loveliness? Mm. Was it turning her into a perfect little doll that everybody wanted to play with? Did it somehow cheat her, rob her of her impulse to rebellion and to independence? Mm. Did it rob her of so much that she might natively and naturally otherwise be? Were she to become an accomplice with them in their perceptions of her, would she end up lopsided on the side of angels? Was Amanda being vampired by love, mm. by a kind of love, by a kind of lovableness? So I suppose that applies to everybody. That's not just because, you know, we grow up in families, we grow up in communities, and we grow up in parts of systems where there's expectations placed on us. But, and we do well, if we do well, the expectations probably grow. But what are we leaving behind, and what are we sacrificing in order to fulfill those kind of expectations, is what he's saying, is what he's saying in the story. Yes. But he continues to talk about Eileen. You won't know who Eileen was, the great love of John's life. John fell in love with Eileen in Connemara, and she was in his cottage this night. So he's remembering a night when he was in Connemara with Eileen, and he's still thinking of the whole idea of love and the sufficiency of love. So John was reading a book. He was very intrigued with the book he was reading, and something he had to stop and think and try and unravel something that he was reading. So he looked up. But when he looked up, he saw that Eileen was in her own, she was reading her own book at the opposite side of the fire, and she was in her own world. And he looked up and he saw her, and he said, "How are you?" I asked. "Deep down in your soul, how are you? In your hands, how are you? In your hair, in your sacred otherness from me, how are you? In your apartness from my love, how are you? How are you, Eileen?" I had sensed and experienced a way of being towards another human being that is deeper than love. It might in some moments include love. Mostly, though, it would be damaged by love, excluded by love. Eileen was puzzled. So I think it's back to the idea that we started off talking about. There's an experience of a different kind of relatedness, a different kind of connection that maybe is deeper than projections. You know, we talked about mirroring at the beginning, and how do you know who you are when you're not being mirrored, or when you're not projecting outwards maybe also, but is to experience the person in their sacred otherness. I mean, how beautiful is that?
Oh, it's an invitation that just keeps unfolding and folding us back in and calling us to keep wondering and wandering with it. And I guess that's why we keep coming back, right? Because we just don't know. There's so much uncertainty, and yet I feel a deep sense of knowing and understanding dawning in all at once.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. He continues, "It was Christmas Eve. To welcome love into the world, we had lighted 6 candles in Granny's 6 windows. Mm. It was as if, in response to a divine invitation, the house had blossomed. As if, in response to a nearer heaven, its chakras had opened. Coming over the brow of Mikey Fitz's hill, I could see the glow of them. Not yet the distinct stars of them. And I was glad, because we now had another light by which to walk, a light to give light to the light of nature. Long before we talk about the dignity of man, we should have the nerve to talk about the possibility of man. What we need is a culture in which we will become possible in ways wonderfully different from previous ways. Yeah, we must be original. So I suppose he brings us back into kind of the sense of the sacred, but sacred, inclusive and integration. And I think, yeah, that's the real gold in the stories, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Amanda, the scope of our conversation that's brought us from the animals in their barn to the, you know, man and child walking on the street, along the lane, I should say. And then just this dance of the light and the dark, and though everyone will just be hearing this, it's just been remarkable to, as we speak, it's as if the afternoon light must be opening up as, because I'm watching it shine on your face as we speak. And it's been such perfect poetry that I couldn't let it go unremarked to have just, it's like, it's as if, I don't know, the skies are opening in the midst of these, of this conversation and these understandings as they unfold.
Oh, it's fascinating. It's very beautiful. And like the synchronicities that happen around John are amazing. You know, yeah. There's just so, like, if you have, people are interested in John's stories, but there are people who see him as a kind of a soul friend. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean that the stories and the writings, and even though he's not around, he is accompanying them in a certain kind of a way on their journey. And that might not be permanent. That might be just for a while. But I think that's fascinating. And that's been the case for me. You know, I find that his wisdom offers great nourishment when, and maybe not when things are going well, maybe that's not when it offers the great nourishment. Maybe it's when things don't go so well in your life and you are seeking and searching. He describes it like he opened a trail. You know, he when he was working, you mentioned he was a gardener in Connemara. And when he worked in Connemara, one of the jobs he did was he was opening an old trail that went through a wood in Letterdyfe. And he had started doing this work, and he was in the shop one day when the local man said to him, you know, that used to be a lover's lane. That used to be a place where lovers used to go and meet because they could be kind of courting and intimate in a way that they couldn't be out in the brightness of day. But that fascinated John, that, you know, we're back to the idea of love in the world. And he was opening a trail, a crooked trail through the woods, and it was a trail of love, if you like. So yeah. I think it all kind of weaves together. John's always weaving things together, and that's part of the great wonder of it.
Yeah. Oh, well, Amanda, I feel like we could talk for days and days and hours, but it just feels such a beautiful place to land us there on that lover's lane and that interweaving. I want to say thank you so much for giving us these stories and your memories. I feel like I want to, let's see if this is an appropriate question to land on, is that 4-year-old girl who was just loved by everyone so much. What are your memories of John? Do you remember that night, or is it hard to, how do you filter that through having been so intimate with his words? What are your memories?
I do kind of remember. I remember John coming home for Christmas. I remember being very small, sitting on the floor because there was never enough chairs. So the children would sit on the floor. And he came through the farmhouse door, and he was enormous. He, you know, he was a big man, but he also had a big head of wild hair. So it's like the whole doorway darkened when he was coming through. And I remember just thinking, my God. As a 4-year-old, he had this presence, like he had an amazing presence. Any room that John was in, and it wasn't something he did. It was just that you knew he was there, and it was, you know, it was a powerful presence that he always had. Mm-hmm. I remember walking the road possibly, but I don't know how much of it is memory and how much of it is from stuff I've heard because I was so young. Those words, when I hear them, you know, the words he speaks directly to me about lovableness and love, I mean, they're so profound in certain ways, because that's kind of stuff that I would struggle with. I mean, I would live mostly kind of on the fringes. I don't like to be, a bit like John, I don't like to be fenced in too much. Yeah. So yeah, it's very interesting to hear them as an adult now spoken and to see the relevance. It's just interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, I am just so grateful for our time to play in the shadows and in the light. It just feels like such a perfect way to be welcoming in the Christmas season together and knowing that we're coming onto the winter solstice times as well. And this play between has just been so palpable and powerful. So thank you so much.
And thank you so much. Time has flown. I can't believe we've gone through all of this. I apologize if there's papers. I have all these papers, but I'm so delighted to be able to do this. And I'm so delighted to be able to speak to you. And thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're so, so welcome. And I'll be sure to tell the listeners about how to find the community on Facebook, which is such a gorgeous and vibrant place. It's the one of the very few reasons I still keep my Facebook account open and active, is that really it's a space to go that's just an oasis in the midst of all the digital everything. So thank you for maintaining such a beautiful place.
I suppose I see it as like scattering seeds.
Yeah.
So just little snippets of John's wisdom, and sometimes they'll fall on fertile ground and sometimes they won't. So that's how I see what I'm doing. And it is, a lot of people really do like it, which is great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you so much. I hope you have a beautiful and Merry Christmas to you and yours. And thank you for coming and being with us today.
And a happy and peaceful Christmas to you too.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.